I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me. It's been great to be at a meeting with quite this diversity in the audience. And I was originally going to be planning to talk about gravity waves from preheating, but then I was asked to make a somewhat more general discussion of classical lattice simulations of preheating, kind of a complement to Jan's talk. So I'm going to start out talking very briefly about reheating and preheating, reviewing the context there, and then talk about lattice simulations. First off, I won't say much about why they're justified, which Jan has just talked about in some detail, but I'll say a few words about that, why they work, and what we can do with them. And then as an example, I will talk about more recent calculations that I and my collaborators and several other groups are doing as well right now on calculating the spectrum of gravity waves produced during preheating. So first, just a quick bit of terminology. I think everyone's familiar with these terms, but I've found people use them in slightly different ways. By reheating, I'm just referring to the completely general transfer of energy from the homogeneous inflaton field to everything else. So essentially, any way that energy moves from the homogeneous inflaton, which is where all the energy is at the end of inflation, to all the things that populate the universe later. And preheating is the first early stage of reheating in many models, where when people were originally thinking about reheating in inflation, they were thinking about perturbative particle decay one by one that would very slowly drain the energy out of the inflaton. And then it was realized in the mid-90s that in many inflationary models, before you have a stage of perturbative decay, there is a rapid burst of non-perturbative exponential growth of fluctuations that drains a huge percentage of the energy out of the inflaton field. And that can occur through a couple mechanisms, but the mechanism where it was originally discovered was through parametric resonance. You have, after inflation, the inflaton in most models at least will be oscillating around some minimum. And then if you couple that inflaton to another field, which I've labeled by chi here, you write the equation of motion for the modes of chi, and it's a simple oscillator equation, but the frequency of that oscillator is itself periodically varying with the oscillating inflaton. Anyone who has studied classical mechanics, or for that matter, anyone who has ever ridden on a playground swing knows that when you have an oscillator and you periodically alter its frequency, the amplitude grows. If there's a resonance between those two frequencies, you get an instability, you get exponential decay, and I've plotted here a plot of the amplitude of one of the modes of k and its occupation number, and it's just exponentially growing with time. So this showed that there would be this explosive burst preheating. And for a while, preheating was essentially synonymous with parametric resonance in the early universe. But several years later, it was realized that there are other mechanisms that can lead to preheating when parametric resonance either doesn't operate or is less efficient. And in particular, if you have a field rolling down a negatively curved potential, there's a tachyonic instability there. And so, for example, in a hybrid inflation model or a new inflation model, the inflaton ends inflation rolling down a potential like this, and fluctuations once again get exponentially stretched out. And I just put this up to emphasize that this is a fairly generic feature. It is not completely generic. It does depend on the parameters of the model. But in a wide variety of inflationary models for a wide range of parameters, you get some kind of preheating. And it can happen by these different mechanisms. Parametric resonance, I'm not going to talk about this one, but it's a related mechanism that can occur in chaotic inflation. In hybrid inflation, it's dominated by tachyonic preheating. In new inflation, sorry about that. Forgot there was a wireless network here. In new inflation, you actually get all of these occurring. And the other point I want to make, aside from the fact that this occurs in a wide variety of inflationary models, is that the results of it are fairly generic as well. These mechanisms, the underlying microscopic mechanism that causes, say, parametric resonance and tachyonic preheating are very different. But if you look at the spectrum of fluctuations that's produced, they have many features in common. What you get is enormously large occupation numbers. What I'm plotting here is occupation number as a function of frequency, and time axis is spectral, going from red to blue. And in all these cases, you end preheating with a spectrum that, as I say, has very large occupation numbers, that has very large occupation numbers specifically in the infrared. There's always a cutoff. These mechanisms are only efficient, only operate below a certain cutoff frequency. So in the infrared, you will typically approach a scaling solution where you have some power loss spectrum followed by an exponential cutoff. And then in a much, much slower process, there'll be a cascade of energy into the ultraviolet, and you will begin populating these modes that were not populated by preheating. And just as a simplified version of the different stages you go through, what I'm showing here now is total integrated number density as a function of time. And what you'll get is preheating, the explosive exponential growth, which in the early stages is linear, and you can simply describe it by solving the ODE for the homogeneous inflaton and then solving the linear equations for all the modes. But towards the end of preheating, you get to a strongly nonlinear stage, and I will describe in a minute what I mean by calling that the nonlinear bubbly stage. It's a term that I stole from Lev Kaufman. Followed by a stage of turbulence that is not strictly Kolmogorov turbulence, but it has many of the same features. It has a power loss scaling with power cascading towards the ultraviolet. And then I do not put thermalization anywhere on this plot because the time scale for thermalization is many, many, many orders of magnitude larger than the time scale for these other processes I'm showing here. And that's crucially important because, as a number of people have noted, with classical lattice simulations, we cannot address full thermalization. However, you can address quite a lot of the dynamics that occur in these early stages. So how exactly does this process work? What I'm going to show here, this is from a tachyonic preheating model, a simple inverted cubic potential. Could be new inflation, could be hybrid inflation. And what I'm plotting here on the horizontal axis is just space, and the vertical axis is field value. And you see you have initial ripples. This movie is not starting right at the end of inflation, but when you've already developed some substantial ripples, and there's slow growth, you don't really see it with your eyes, until there's an explosive period of growth in a few isolated bubbles. And then the energy spreads out from those regions to produce fluctuations over the entire space. You have these walls spreading out. In the interior of the bubble, you can see it's still oscillating. And so it sends out these concentric walls. And this is actually from a 3D simulation. It's a 2D slice. So those walls are spreading out in more or less spherical pattern, although not perfectly spherical, which will be important later when I talk about gravity waves. So how do you address that question? Well, the early linear stages you can just solve by hand analytically, but of course in the later stages when you have that complicated bubbly dynamics, you need to do numerical simulations. And so this is essentially what you're doing. You're solving the coupled equations for all the fields, and I put a subscript on there to indicate that you simply do this for all the fields you may have in your problem. I've only included here scalars, but you can do this with vectors as well. Of course, you cannot do it with fermions in this way. And then coupled to that, you have the Friedman equation, the expansion of the universe. And again, I won't go into the justification for the using the classical approximation here because it's been discussed so much, except to note that in any case where you have preheating, you get enormously large occupation numbers. And it has been calculated analytically and verified numerically over and over that classical approximation is valid here. So I'm going to mention here the lattice simulation program that Igor Kochhoff and I developed, and I mention it not to say that it is the only lattice simulation program out there, or even to say that it is better than the other ones out there, but to say that it is the most easily adaptable, publicly available one. There are lots of people doing very powerful lattice simulations with a variety of codes. And I just mentioned lattice easy to say that what it is specifically designed for is so that other users can easily download it. You simply write in the equations for the potential you want and write in the parameters you want for the run. There's a specific place for each of those, compile and run. And then it'll solve the evolution equations and generate whatever outputs you want. And as has been emphasized before, the only approximations you're using there are classicality, which is extremely good in the regime we're talking about, and of course discretization, which you can make arbitrarily good. You have control over that. And this is a somewhat arbitrary sample just of the kinds of output you can get from these lattice simulations. Essentially anything you want to know about the evolution of these fields. Means and variances over time, spectra like the ones I showed before, histograms of the field distributions, slice like the movie I showed before. This is the time evolution of a bubble in a first order phase transition. So it's an incredibly powerful tool, but what happened is when preheating was discovered in the early 90s, very shortly after that, people started doing these lattice simulations. And as with any new tool that people start using, not the lattice simulations are a new tool, but newly applied to this topic of preheating, people rapidly went through all the easy problems. All the things that you could just sit down and kind of bang out, people started doing simple toy models, and tremendous progress was made, and I'll briefly mention just a few of the things that were discovered that way. But we're starting to tap out that level of things, and the problems that I and many other people are addressing now with these simulations are getting much more complicated. We want to do much more realistic models with far more interactions, more complex interactions, more fields, and so on. And so the demand on computing power is increasing, and so I think more and more what's going to be happening in the future, let me come back to that in a second. Sorry, that got out of order, is parallel, the use of large parallel computers. So I'll just make a quick plug here for anyone who's interested in doing simulations of this type. About 2 months ago, we just released the parallel programming version of Lattice Easy. It's available on the Lattice Easy website. I've been using it to do simulations of grids of 1,024 cubed with up to 9 fields. The gravity wave results I'll show you in a few minutes are from 1,024 cubed simulations. And at that point, you're only limited by the size of the cluster you have available to you. Let me skip that. And just, this is a somewhat arbitrary, tiny sample of the things I could have put up here of the history of some of the results that have been obtained with these kinds of simulations. The discovery and characterization of parametric resonance and tachyonic preheating, not the discovery of parametric resonance, but characterization of it, investigation of phase transitions, showing whether a phase transition is first order or second order, showing the density of defects you produce, showing the rate of baryogenesis in various models, and so on. And then, as I say, I want to end by focusing on one particular application that three independent groups have been working on for the last couple years. Although I should also note, actually, I didn't include it on here, but this is all built, in a sense, on some earlier work, much earlier work on this topic by Igor Kochhoff. And I will not spend much time motivating why this is an interesting question, the calculation of gravity waves from preheating, except to quickly note the early universe was, of course, opaque to electromagnetic radiation, but transparent to gravity waves. Once you produce them, they decouple essentially instantly and then pass through the universe almost unimpeded. And also, to note that it's incredibly important to get any handle we can on that early stage. I would contend that the stage from the end of inflation through the establishment of thermal equilibrium is one of, if not the most poorly understood epochs in cosmological history. Inflation itself, we don't know the exact model, but the physics is extremely simple. Once you have a thermalized plasma, we have a pretty good handle on how to talk about that, not that there aren't big open questions. But when you talk about this intermediate stage, not only do we not know the model and the interactions, but we really have virtually no observational or theoretical constraints on the level that we do for those other epochs. So anything that gives us a handle, a direct observational window into that area, is incredibly important. And of course, you might naturally think gravity waves could be produced then, because you have huge concentrations of matter and energy sloshing around in very chaotic, inhomogeneous patterns. The calculation itself is, in principle, fairly straightforward. You calculate the perturbations of the metric source by the transverse traceless part of the energy momentum tensor, which you can obtain just by projecting out in Fourier space. I can go through the details of that for anyone who wants, but a simple projection operator, and then you use that to calculate the density and gravity waves, where that average has to be taken over a spatial area larger than the wavelength of the gravity wave you're interested in. And so once you have that equation and you have a lot of simulation that's calculating the evolution of the fields, you can simply plug this in, add that to your calculation, and get a real-time evolution of gravity waves, and then fairly simple analytical extension to calculate what those spectra look like today, because they do nothing but redshift between then and now. So when we first developed these calculations, and by we, again, there are several groups doing this independently, we applied it first to the easiest model, which is a chaotic inflation model, simply lambda phi to the fourth. The nice thing about that model is it's very simple, very easy to work with, and whether you call it nice or not nice depends on your point of view, but the key feature of a model like that is that there are really no free parameters. The energy scale is set. And the short answer, as far as observing gravity waves from preheating after chaotic inflation, is it's completely hopeless. We heard earlier that if we're going to observe gravity waves, they had better be in a window of at most 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3 hertz or lower, down to about 10 to the minus 4. The energy scales are so large in chaotic inflation that the physical scales at which things are happening, the bubbles, are very, very small, and today those gravity waves would have a peak frequency of about 10 to the 8 hertz. And you can't get around that in chaotic inflation, but what you can do is consider hybrid inflation. I won't go through the details of hybrid inflation, which Andre Linde discussed on the first day, but the crucial thing that I need about it is that it decouples the inflationary dynamics from the energy scale of inflation. So the energy scale now becomes a tunable parameter, and you can construct a much lower scale model of hybrid inflation, which could then, in principle, push the frequency today of those gravity waves lower and possibly into the observable range. And the reason you're getting these gravity waves, the time when you're really producing these gravity waves goes back to what I discussed earlier about this nonlinear bubbly stage that occurs right at the end of preheating. You get rapid growth of bubbles, and what I'm showing here, over here it's field value, and again this is a two-dimensional slice through a three-dimensional simulation, and I'm starting at the moment when you can just see a bubble starting to form. And what I'm plotting over here is the energy density in gravity waves on a log scale, as I discussed before. And what you see is as that bubble grows, it produces a sphere of gravity waves around it. And that's in part because the bubble is not perfectly spherically homogeneous. It does have a quadrupole moment. And also, you can see in the later parts of the simulation, as different bubbles begin to collide, you can also produce gravity waves from that. And so then the question becomes, certainly we know this process would produce gravity waves, would they end up in the observable range? And I am running short on time, but I can very quickly tell you the answer, which is probably not. Again, I can go into the details, but I don't have time to right now, but there are several adjustable parameters in a hybrid inflation model. There's the self-coupling of the Higgs, there's the coupling of the Higgs to the inflaton, and another crucial parameter comes from this inflationary potential, which for the most part does not affect the reheating dynamics at all, except if you look at the hybrid inflation potential, inflation ends when the rolling field reaches this bifurcation point and you get symmetry breaking. The inflationary potential determines the velocity with which the inflaton is going to pass through that field. And it turns out the higher that velocity, the higher frequency gravity waves you're going to produce, because you're going to roll out to a more sharply curved part of the potential. So you're going to produce higher frequency modes. So you would think, okay, in the limit where you tune that velocity down to zero, you could produce arbitrarily low frequency modes because the curvature goes to zero here. But actually, if you have very low velocity, then you're dominated by quantum diffusion, which samples a region around the bifurcation point. And so you get this minimum possible frequency that you can get as a function of lambda. And to get a spectrum that would cross, say, the expected sensitivity of BBO, you would, in the most optimistic possible setting, need lambda to be no bigger than about 10 to the minus 14, the self-coupling of the Higgs. And that's assuming that you have a very, very small velocity of the inflaton passing through the bifurcation point. That's also assuming a fairly large VEV for the Higgs, so that the amplitude is high enough for you to observe. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying you kind of have to bend over backwards and touch your knee with your nose to make this model work. No, lambda here is the self-coupling of the Higgs. The inflaton potential is completely decoupled from that. So, to put a more positive spin on this, however, the prospects of observing gravity waves from preheating do not look great, although it is not completely ruled out. But the same technique, using lattice simulations to calculate this, can be applied to any other scenario. At this point, essentially, if you can write down, either numerically or analytically, the time evolution of an energy momentum tensor, any energy momentum tensor whatsoever, then we can simply plug it into a lattice simulation and calculate the production of gravity waves very simply. And so we're starting to look at other places where we can calculate that. And I'm out of time, so I will just put this up and thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Dan?
So you were discussing what happens with gravitational waves when you create some topological defect. But can you say something about whether gravitational or other non-gravitational, non-perturbative channels would dominate the decay process of these defects?
I can't say much about that because I have not done those simulations. I've done a lot of simulations of the formation of defects. To look at their ultimate decay is a much longer time scale. So clearly you have, I mean, to some extent it depends on the parameters. As I say, I have certainly worked with models where if you have very fast reconnection, you can get rid of the vast majority of your defects quickly and end up with, say, you know, in a string model, one string per horizon size. If the question is, can you have situations where, say, gravitational effects would dominate over that, I wouldn't venture to say one way or another. I don't know. Yeah.
Is old-style perturbative reheating ever important?
Yes. It's important in two situations. First off, again, preheating is model-dependent. It is parameter-dependent, really, I should say. It happens in virtually any model if you have the right parameter. You can always find a range of parameters where preheating will not be effective if the ratios of the couplings are too small, for example. And we do not have any way of ruling that out. But even if you have a model where there is preheating is essentially never, actually, preheating is virtually never, there's at least one exception I can think of, virtually never completely efficient. It always leaves you with some relic homogeneous condensate of the inflaton. And so after preheating, you always have a stage of perturbative decay that's part of the process towards complete thermalization, but it's not old style because you're suddenly in this bath of these enormous fluctuations that you produce, so the setting is completely different.
Any more questions? So if not, thank Gary again. And we are back at 2 o'clock.